Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Catriona Gold. Today, I'll be interviewing Eugene T. Richardson about his new book, Epidemic Illusions on the Coloniality of Global Public Health, which was published with MIT Press in 2020. Eugene Richardson is assistant professor of global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School, visiting faculty at the University of Global Health Equity in Butaro, Rwanda, and chair of the Lancet Commission on Reparations and Redistributive Justice. Welcome to the show, Eugene.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to be talking to you about this book, which is absolutely fascinating. So I want to start out first by asking, because it's pertinent, if you could tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I am... American, born in New Jersey, grew up in Florida. And I guess I'd say I really started getting involved in global health after I finished undergraduate. I went on a mission with Doctors Without Borders to the Sudan. And this is before I went to medical school because I had studied microbiology. I was able to work as a lab supervisor at one of the field hospitals there. And it was a pretty, the experience left a lot of impressions on me, but I think it was where I first started seeing what is this double-edged sword that is aid and humanitarianism and global health. And what happened there was we were working in the southern part of the country, and this was before South Sudan had gained its independence. And we were working at a field hospital in a place called Bentiu. And the reason that field hospital had been set up was mainly because there was a large camp of internally displaced persons. So that is essentially refugees, but within a country. A lot of these people had lived more north, but there were Arab militias and mujahideen from the north that had been burning them out of their villages and sending them south. And they were doing this so that the Chinese could do oil exploration in those areas sort of uninterrupted. And then the oil was piped up to the Port Sudan. And as the people, lost their livelihoods, lost their cattle, they were sent south and would come to these camps where we would take care of them for things like, TB, malaria, leishmaniasis, acute malnutrition. And I got to be friends with some of the doctors at the military garrison nearby, which is, serving the North's military, because this was basically a front line in a civil war between the North and South. And they told me that MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, was part of their military strategy. I thought to myself, whoa, what do you mean by that? And they said, because we, want to do that oil exploration, we're, sending people out of their villages and, you are taking care of them in these camps. You're basically curing disease, curing malnutrition, but you're also hiring people, paying nurses $100 a month, which can support up to 40, extended family members. And so a lot of these people are not, you know, hitting rock bottom enough that they would join the SPLA, the Southern People's Liberation Army. So it's like this strategy actually helps our enemy ranks from not swelling. So you are part of our military strategy. I thought, wow, I never knew that, you know, there was such, you know, political ends humanitarian work could be used for. You know, in this sense, it's a form of internal colonialism, as we would call it. And so, you know, I was obviously very naive at the time because, you know, if I had read, I would have known that, you know, from Biafra to the Hutus in DRC after the Rwandan genocide, there are many ways that humanitarian missions have been used for kind of geopolitical ends. But this was my first real experience of it, to see that, you know, okay, this, you know, aid, humanitarianism is a kind of a two-edged sword. But then I started reading more and working more in the global South and, you know, in reading people like Kwame Nkrumah, who said as early as the 1960s, you know, aid is a revolving credit where a little bit is given in to continue a huge amount of extraction that comes out. So for me, Sudan was like a sort of a microcosm of that because it was an internal colony. But, you know, when you started looking at bigger development projects, you could see that, you know, development is almost, you know, I've come to see it as a farce, essentially, that, and if you look at the statistics, I think it's easy to prove that statement. Let's use the continent of Africa. The stats from 2017 are something like, you know, $60 billion, or I think it's, yeah, $60 billion went into the continent in the form of aid, loans, and remittances. $200 billion came out in illicit financial flows. This is not, you know, repatriation of profits. This is illegal theft of money through tax evasion, trade misinvoicing, resource theft. And so the continent is a net creditor of something like $40 billion per year to the global north. I mean, they are developing us. And so the idea that we have this USAID, United States Agency for International Development, is a total farce, because really, Kwame Nkrumah's words ring true. A little bit is being given, and it's disguising what our corporations continue to do, whether it be via mining, logging, all sorts of industries that extract through illicit flows. And that's why I'll say something like, you know, the Panama Papers to me were a huge global health intervention in the past 5 years, because they're really starting to lift the lid on this neocolonial extraction. And so to finish the story, you know, I initially saw aid and development as a way to disguise this extraction. And I think that's been written a lot about. But what I further came to notice was that even what we call global health science, like the public health work we do there, it aids in this cover-up. So what we think of as an objective, value-free, neutral public health science is actually part of this apparatus of disguising, illicit flows to the global north. And so the book is essentially about not the aid part of it, but how what we call public health science, epidemiology, things like that, how that abets continued neocolonial extraction. And I just use a variety of examples of, you know, this may look like a neutral scientific project, but here's how it aids this continued system of extraction. So that's, you know, 20 years later, that's where I arrived.
All right. So, I mean, okay, so the intervening 20 years, was there anything in particular that prompted you to write this book, you know, here, mm-hmm. now? I guess that's what I'm curious about, how you came to write it.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of that story is also before I went to medical school, I had done pre-med as an undergraduate, but really did not see doing clinical work in the U.S. as what I wanted to do for 100% of my life. I was thinking about how, more globally, I guess you could say. And that's when I started reading Paul Farmer, who is my current boss, and, learned about how, it's not just the biology that makes people sick, right? You know, a virus jumps into a person, makes them sick, a tumor forms and makes them sick from cancer, that social forces can actually get into the body and make people sick. And I think that was really transformative to start to understand that, how structural violence, how social forces become embodied as pathology, as we would say. And that got me really interested in getting back on the med school path, but also pulling into that path ways of understanding, the social determinants of health. And so I went to medical school, went to residency, and then ended up doing a PhD in anthropology during my infectious disease subspecialty training, which is similar to the path that Paul Farmer took. And so, I was really influenced by his writings early on to pursue a study of you could call it social epidemiology, disease distribution, but how it's determined by not only current social forces, but historical forces as well. And so I think that coupled with the experience of aid and starting to see public health science as a double-edged sword, coalesced. And then another formative experience was working in 2014, I started working in the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone. And I think that gave me a real, I just finished my infectious disease fellowship, so I was a qualified physician, so I had the ability to see things from a clinician's point of view, but I had also finished much of my PhD, so I had the tools to understand things from that, contextualizing discipline. And with my colleagues there, came to understand the outbreak in terms of some of the more socio-historical forces. But then, in wanting to write about it, I saw that a lot of people had done the good work of tracing, the such things. I mean, Paul even has a new book out, Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, which does that very thing, is the colonial history of how, that set the foundation for weak health systems and a large Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And so I thought, there's people much better than me writing about, using empirical data, using historical evidence to demonstrate how outbreaks like this, evolve from colonial legacies. And so I thought I'd like to speak to another audience, maybe more the practitioners that are involved in, studying and accounting for and working in these outbreaks. And the reason the book takes the form that it does, which is very experimental and there's a lot of different, heuristics from flash fiction to reverse ethnographies to counter hegemonic modeling, is that, what I'm giving is sort of a critique of modernity, right? Is that, the idea that we can come to these objective views of why things happen, of why this outbreak happened, of why this person got sick and this person didn't get sick. There are many ways of parsing health phenomena. And so I kind of, I approached the book experimentally to sort of rattle that up, to rattle up our Western tradition of that, science can get us to a objective, neutral description of what we see as far as social phenomena. And that's where the cover of the book comes out of. The cover is essentially a play on Plato's cave. I can talk some more about that if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd really like to hear more about the cover. I was intrigued by it. And then when I saw that you commissioned it, right? Conceived of it. And I was trying to work it out before I started reading the book. Obviously, I know you're not supposed to be judging the book by its cover, but if it's, when it's a cover this fascinating, I think maybe a bit of leeway, but yeah, I would love to hear more about it.
Yeah, so I had made a very crude drawing of this, and an artist here in the Bay Area, Lena Gustafson, made it into the very pretty cover that it is. And so I'm in debt to her. And it essentially, you know, Plato's cave is the allegory of the cave is that there are prisoners stuck in a cave and they're chained to a wall. And all they can see are these shadows on the wall, because behind them, other people are walking with like figurines, and there's a fire that projects the shadows onto the wall. And then one of their lot, you know, usually it's thought of the philosopher, or in my case, I guess it would be the social scientist, is able to sneak out, get up into the real world and say, oh my God, this is what things really look like. And then they come back and they say, this is what, you know, you're just looking at shadows on a wall. This is what reality truly is. And so that's kind of a tradition we've inherited, that there is always this objective way of describing things, and is what I think it what powers social science, you know, this idea that when we look at social phenomena, we can come up with an answer that reflects that reality. And I have a, you know, very, you know, different opinion on it, you know, which stems back as far as, you know, the neo-Kantians, which would say, no, there's a very big difference between the natural sciences and the, and say social inquiry. And not that one's better than the other, but they're very different forms of inquiry. So that, you know, natural science is looking for more causal explanations, more laws that, you know, are unchanging. So, you know, three quarks make a proton, and masks prevent viral particles from entering your body, and tobacco is a carcinogen and can cause cancer. But when you're talking about actual social phenomena that say that is in something that involves human behavior, that there can be no laws, there's no equations that will tell us, you know, how people are acting in the future. What there is interpretation. Because social phenomena are so complex, our attempts to reduce that complexity through models or descriptions will always distort the reality of it. And we have to make choices about what variables we're going to use, what methods, what modes of interpretation we're going to use. And for me, that is not scientific. That is actually, that is more of a, you know, falls under an interpretivist line. And I'm not saying that anything goes. Like, I don't believe in sort of a full relativity, because you are constrained in what you're saying. You know, this Ebola outbreak started because ... It didn't start because a magic white pumpkin fell out of the sky and exploded and Ebola came out of it. Like, we're constrained within our facts. But you could choose to say that, you know, the facts are that there are people that didn't believe that Ebola existed and that, you know, they thought it was a U.S. bioweapon. And you could say, okay, if only they understood virology and took the vaccine, then there wouldn't be any outbreak. And so we have their ignorance to blame. So that is a explanation of causation, because it's based in facts. Yeah, you talk to people and they might say, yeah, Ebola is a U.S. bioweapon and that's why I'm not going to get the vaccine. Or you could talk to them further and bring some history into it and see that, you know, there is a habitual distrust of, you know, foreign interventions in a place where over 200 years, people have had their hands cut off for not collecting enough rubber. You know, colonialists have in Belgium and have extracted wealth to the tune of trillions of dollars. The U.S. has, you know, was involved in killing their first elected prime minister and installing a puppet dictator in Mobutu, who took a little bit of money from the U.S. and then allowed our corporations to run rampant in resource extraction, which they continue to do. You know, where I was working in North Kivu, there's a company, Anglo Gold Ashanti, which is a foreign entity, takes about 93% of the wealth from the gold they extract, leaving just 7% for the country. You know, the chief shareholder of that company was John Paulson, who gave $400 million to Harvard, and now we have the Paulson School of Engineering. So the net of extraction continues to this day, and it continues to, you know, my front door at Harvard. And this is, you know, this is what I'm trying to do, and, you know, others have done a much better job of it. But tracing the determinative web of this continued extraction, you know, it's not lost on the people there. And so it's very logical. It makes sense that, you know, they would not trust, you know, foreign interventions into the outbreak. And that's another explanation that is based in facts, but has more of an eye towards social historical justice instead of just neoliberal individuality. And that's what I mean by, the cover, which is essentially a bunch of caves, or I call it a warren. So that there's not just one cave that, people can go to and have an idea about what's going on. There are many. So there are many interpretations of social phenomena that vie for the forefront of our consciousness. And the one that usually gets hold is the one that's supported by elites. I mean, this is what Gramsci means by cultural hegemony, right? The interpretations that prevail are the ones that support elite interests. And so if you're interested in supporting social justice, part of it is an epistemic revolution, right? You support views that support this justice. So in the case of the Ebola outbreak in DRC, it's supporting the view that it's not people's ignorance that is causing it, but that it is legacies of colonial extraction. And that's what I mean by redescription. That's a redescription of using facts of what might be a cause. And a group that has access to more facts from the past, that has more experiential data, could go back even further and say, well, this is an even more just redescription. And so that's the idea of the cover, that there are pluriversal ways of describing social phenomena that, again, vie for our attention, and that there's ideology behind all of them. There's justice ideologies, there's extractive ideologies, and the idea is to find, like, what is the ideology that's cooking, up the way we're parsing facts, the way we're curating facts. The cover kind of discusses the book in a nutshell, in that, I'm promoting pluriversal understanding of health phenomena.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's incredible. I think we should start to get into some of those ways in which you get at these questions, right? These multiple factors and possible interpretations. I really like how sort of provocative and playful a lot of these chapters are. And I suppose one of the ones that really stood out for me. So we've got flash fiction, we've got platonic dialogues, we've got semiotics, call and response, symbolic reparations, and border gnosis, and we also have counter hegemonic modeling, and it's and a whole bunch of other stuff is going on at the same time. The one which, I'm a sucker for it. I love it. I would really like to hear more about how you approached chapter, or rather redescription number 3, which is a Nasarima ethnography.
Yeah, so the Nasarima ethnography is based on a similar, you could say, ploy from, decades ago. That was, Nasarima backwards is American. And so I came across this, I think, when I was in a sociology class as an undergrad in the 90s. And essentially, it's an ethnography of Americans. But, it takes a little bit to realize what's going on there, but it's like, say an anthropologist from Africa had arrived in the U.S. and was describing our crazy rituals, to kind of help relativize, what we, and it's good for students, what we think as sort of just natural behaviors or natural phenomena are actually, socially constructed, have history behind them, and would seem very strange to people, that not from our culture. So, one thing I think is, strange to people in parts of the world is that we wear braces, right? And who cements metal to their teeth and undergoes pain for 3 years to, make things a little straighter? I think in the Nasarima thing, they talk about our bathroom rites where we brush with horsehair every day. I'm reminded of, there's a great documentary or mockumentary, you want to call it, called Barbecue Area from Australia. And it's about a group of Aboriginal sailors who arrive in a colonial ship to a beach in Australia and land. And there's a, you know, white people barbecuing on the beach, and they come up to them and they say, you know, what is this land? And the people say, it's the barbecue area. And they say, okay, we claim barbecue area in the name of, you know, their country. And then it proceeds out from there as kind of an exploration of like, you know, what reverse contact, initial contact would have looked like. And I think that it's helpful in sort of, you know, getting people to understand, right, how things are socially constructed, how there's not a, not universals as far as behavior or ethics or anything like that. And so the idea was to use that same model to explore the WHO and the primitive tribes of Lake Geneva, as I called them. And so, you know, I go through and talk about how I made friends with them so I could, you know, understand their rights. And I look at some of their parchments, you know, written by Max Weber, but, write it off as I came across some ancient scrolls or something like that. And so the goal is to kind of flip things on their head so that you can see that, you know, a lot of what goes on in the belly of the beast where global health decisions are made and, you know, a lot of the NGOs have all of their practices are not only contrived and socially constructed, but they're also very, you know, self-serving. They have agendas that, you know, like I mentioned, as far as, extractive economies that support the global north. I mean, here is it's one way of trying to re-describe things so that that argument is made. Instead of saying WHO is the hand, you know, or UN organizations are also the handmaiden of neocolonial extraction, here's a way of kind of exploring it in a novel fashion so that maybe the categories that we're used to every day that we think of as natural kind of get rattled around so that we see them as somewhat more constructed.
Right. Yeah. Sort of a show don't tell approach is, I feel, evident in some of these chapters. And that I feel that playfulness, yeah, really allows you to get at things in a way that's really, it's a really helpful illustration of some of these questions.
I wonder if
you'd like to walk us through. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, what I'm doing is essentially critiquing modernity. I mean, modernity is kind of founded on this notion that there are, scientific, like everything has its explanation, and we can quantify everything, and everything has nice sharp edges. And so to critique modernity, it's hard to, you know, if you want to say that there are other ways of seeing the world, you don't want to use logic and equations to show that, because it's sort of using the master's tools. And so the idea of the book was that, yeah, you can't critique modernity using its terms of reference, and hence the variety of approaches to try to, shake out a different understanding. You had mentioned the chapter on counter-hegemonic modeling, and that has actually become, a part of my practice after the publication of the book. We just put out a paper in February that was called Reparations for Descendants of People Enslaved in the U.S. and Their Potential Impact on COVID Transmission. And the idea behind this one was sort of, you know, both worlds. It was to make a critique of, you know, the current models we use really just reinforce status quo, right? You know, moving to the COVID outbreak, we have 30 something million cases, 600,000 deaths in the U.S., but there's still a huge disparity in Black people dying. You know, three times more than white populations, and a lot of the modeling and the studies and the interventions didn't really take that into account. They would say, let's wear masks, let's social distance, close some businesses, do some stay at home, but there was no interventions into risk structure. Like, why is it that people of color were suffering higher incidence and mortality? And so, you know, if you take Ibram Kendi's definition of a racist policy or even a racist analysis is one that continues status quo disparities, then these analyses could be looked at as racist because they're not doing anything to imagine a future where these disparities don't exist. And so that's what we did. We tried to, bring into the social imaginary, what would it look like to have racial justice interventions? And what effect would that have on COVID? And we found that essentially eradicating the wealth gap, which is what we were calling for in our package of reparations, and the wealth gap between Black and white Americans is $10 trillion. If that had been eradicated many years ago, we found that our current outbreak would probably be 30 to 60% less. I mean, it's a big gap, but it's hard to specifically quantify. And that's just through, better housing, better ability to social distance, less overcrowded housing, less people, of color being forced to work in frontline work. And so to me, that was kind of a form of anti-racist modeling. And it draws from the book in that it's trying to explode current approaches, the status quo approaches to interpreting global health phenomena, which the book argues really just continue to perpetuate that status quo, and tries to move into more of the realm of, okay, well, we want to continue using these tools. What would it look like to actually do some anti-racist epidemiology? And so that article's out in Social Science and Medicine. And now we're working on another study on environmental racism and COVID. So, people are starting to show that places with poor air quality have higher incidence and higher mortality from COVID. So, maybe the pollution is affecting the lung lining such that you can get infected more and that you can, also suffer higher mortality rates. And so if you take that further and show that, well, there are places in the U.S. that either through redlining or the way cities were set up, that people of color were placed in the places forcibly where the air quality is worse, then you have a mechanism, you could tie redlining essentially to higher COVID mortality. So it's not just people are in overcrowded housing. It's the inability of governments to meet EPA guidelines in the poorer parts of cities. And so that comes back again to the government for, health phenomena that occur decades later. And so we're modeling what it would look like if these goals had been met, if air quality was improved, how many people's lives would have been saved. And I think it's partly to show that that's something we need to do and partly to help people understand that, it's not just COVID. It's not just overcrowding. It's like, what are the mechanisms by which racism gets into people's body? It makes people sicker. And this is, this would provide another example.
It said you were offline for 1 second. We'll edit this bit out. Are you here now? Are we cool? Do we have a connection?
Yeah, okay. I can hear you.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Just checking. Whatever. Maybe I've created an interruption. but we'll edit it anyway. All right. Let's press on. I really like this idea of counter hegemonic modeling. And you're linking up really well here the kind of more speculative, I suppose, approach of the book and this sort of playful techniques in there with the actual, the work you're doing and how it does have this real world applicability too, right? Critique isn't just critique. It has to do with practice. And I think you make that really clear. I'm wondering if there's any of the other techniques in here you'd like to get into while we're here.
The first chapter, the flash fiction, which a lot of, readers have said, oh, that was, I didn't know that that was how you, grew up or came to it. This story is not about me. it's sort of your archetypal, I guess, you know, white, liberal, wealthy individual. I mean, maybe there are some elements that I pulled from my history. But interestingly, that just to give a quick description to the audience, flash fiction is essentially, you know, the attempt to tell a novel in under 500 or 1,000 words. And they have, you know, great, you know, the competitions around the world, and there's some really great stories. There's an apocryphal, I think it's maybe one sentence or two sentences that's attributed to Hemingway, but I think it came out before. And it's something like, baby shoes for sale, never worn. And so it's one sentence, but it's very sad. It's very evocative. It allows you to think of all sorts of things that could have happened. So the flash fiction I use is kind of a coming of age of a white American student who learns that, he's not just sort of this wealthy Zion of liberalism and democracy, but that he's really a product of coloniality, a product of extraction from the rest of the world. And so the interesting thing about it, though, it was picked up by the DSA, or Democratic Socialists of America. They actually just took that chapter and put it on their website as a blog, which I thought was nice, and was part of what, my hope for the book, that it was sort of this modular thing that people could take and pick little pieces of it that they thought relevant to whatever. And I guess DSA thought it was relevant to kind of shaking people's ideas about, you know, where our wealth and prosperity comes from. That to me was a pleasant surprise when they did that. Let's see what else is in there. And then the Platonic dialogue was fun. I admittedly, you know, there's critiques of it where, you know, I have basically have a dialogue between Kwame Nkrumah and Charles Peirce. Peirce is considered the father of American pragmatism, and Kwame Nkrumah is the first president of Ghana and a great African philosopher. People have critiqued it for me forming their voices and kind of telling the world what they would say if they were alive today. And so I'm sorry for that. But the goal of it was to kind of explain the cover, was to give, is based on the actual Socratic dialogue where they talk about the allegory of the cave, and just turned into a dialogue about what a warren might, you know, if Plato had written an allegory of a warren, what that dialogue might look like. So that was kind of fun. But it also behind it has my ideas on epistemic revolution and, you know, deconstructing this universal claims to knowledge to welcoming the pluriversal.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's such a lot going on here. And it's great to know that you're open to people sort of taking up parts of it and running with it. I didn't know that the DSA had republished, or essentially, you know, some of it, but that's fantastic. It seems wrong to call the book accessible, given that it touches on so many quite high concepts, but also it is. I think it does function as a very accessible introduction to these kind of techniques and critical ways of thinking, and, you know, as you say, critiques of modernity. So in that sense, you know, could be quite useful as a course text, you know, or of course for the general reader. I think this should have a sort of an audience beyond the academy. I suppose you've told us a bit about what you're working on now, which is usually my last question. Is there anything else you'd like to mention on that note, or maybe future plans for work before we wrap up?
Sure. So I've just been working with the Africa CDC and the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health. And I think just yesterday we submitted the first COVID antibody survey from the African continent. And we found that that overall in Sierra Leone, the prevalence was not that high. It was 2.8% overall, which is much, much better than, you know, countries in Europe and the Americas. In the capital city, it was more on the order of 5%, which, you know, makes sense because people are in more congregate settings. But what it did show is that if you look at that prevalence, how many people that means are infected throughout the country, 200 something thousand, and you look at how many cases they've actually reported over the year, that there's actually 43 times underreporting based on the surveillance they've been able to do. And that has a lot to do with, availability of resources, you know, global north snatching up not only the methods of testing, but we've seen through this vaccine apartheid, all of the vaccines as well. And that's, you know, a huge problem for a country that, you know, now we're saying they're only 97% of the people are susceptible, even maybe the 3% if the Delta variant can get through acquired immunity to previous variants. But also that a third wave is moving through Africa at the moment. And they're starting to report as many as 80, 90 cases a day. And if that underreporting that we understood from March is still true, that means there's actually 3,000 to 4,000 cases per day. And so our worry is that, you know, even though there's, we're worried about a huge wave sweeping the continent, that it's much, much bigger. It could be 30 to 40 times bigger than what we're seeing. And this, you know, reinforces claims, not only for stronger containment measures, but people that the work that people have been doing as far as vaccine justice. You know, it doesn't make any sense that to me that we have leftover vaccines here that people aren't taking, or that we're trying to get, you know, 12 to 18 year olds vaccine when there are healthcare workers and adults and elderly individuals dying across the spectrum in sub-Saharan Africa, in India, that this vaccine apartheid is really, causing a huge amount of deaths around the world. You know, we're starting now to try to build out the ability to, produce mRNA vaccines, but even the waiver for that at the WTO, to waive the intellectual property for it, which was supported by Biden, is being blocked by European countries. So even our attempts, which should have started a year ago and only are starting now, to really improve access are being thwarted. And so here's another example of, you know, in the book, I call it coloniality, you can call it neocolonialism at work, the protection of big pharma profits at the expense of people dying across the global south. And so even in, your standard epidemiology work, which is knowing your outbreak, which is what we did with the antibody survey, there are ways of using it to understand the justice implications. And the justice implications for the third wave moving for Africa are that the vaccine apartheid being spearheaded by the global north is killing lots of people, and that blood is on the hands of big pharma, the German government and the French government. In response to that, Africa CDC has been working to try to develop the manufacturing, and Paul Kagame from Rwanda is leading this effort. But they've come across so much resistance, and they're only able to start a year and almost a year and a half after the outbreak has started. You can see this is in real time, like what coloniality looks like, what are global South countries up against when it's profits versus people. I mean, this is you could use this example for rubber and ivory extraction 200 years ago, and you can use it today for vaccine production. That's essentially what the book gets at, is that, you know, colonialism by another name exists today, whether you want to call it neocolonialism or neoliberalism. But that extraction, that approach to profits over people's lives still continues, and we're seeing the horrible ramifications of it now through this vaccine injustice.
Right. Yeah, that's that seems like a very appropriate point at which to end, and I hope underscores the importance of the book to our listeners, who I highly recommend it. I want to say thank you so much for your time today, Eugene. This has been Catriona Gold talking to Eugene T. Richardson of Harvard University about his new book, came out in 2020 with MIT Press, Epidemic Illusions on the Coloniality of Global Public Health. Thanks again, Eugene, and I hope to have you on the show again for your next book.
Thanks so much. Yes, I hope our paths cross soon.